Channel 2 Right and beginning of the talk with Jack on his Army experience is Tuesday afternoon, the 21st of May, 74. Channel 2 Right, beginning of Channel 2 Right and beginning of the talk with Jack about his, Jack Long about his Army experiences this Tuesday, the 21st of May, 74. Channel 2 Right and beginning of the talk with Jack on his Army experiences this Tuesday afternoon, the 21st of May, 74.
I've reached a point where I can't read too long at any one time. It takes a while after I stop reading to get my eyes refocused.
Really?
Yeah. You know, they don't change the focus as rapidly as
it did. Uh-huh. Well, strange thing where your eyes do.
Since when did that happen?
This has been the last couple of years.
They don't change focus.
Oh, just say after I'm reading up close with these bifocals, it takes a little while when I stop reading.
Well, they're not. You're not new to bifocals.
Well, I've been wearing them for a couple of years.
And all?
Just a couple. Yes.
Well, it looks like bifocals would rest eyes make them adapt quicker.
Yeah, I think so. Well, for a while I used reading glasses.
Oh, I see.
And then I got bifocals.
I see.
I just still don't know how we got into your Army experience. We were out in Texas, and you were an instructor.
In Texas? How'd you get there? I've never been in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
This was Aberdeen Proving Ground.
Aberdeen, not in Texas?
No, it's in Maryland.
Oh, I got the wrong state, didn't I?
Right. Aberdeen Proving Grounds is a big center for ordnance, during the war. Ordnance trainer, basic training, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Ordnance school, and testing ground, too.
And you were established there?
Well, when I finished basic training, they put me in the ordnance school as an instructor. I didn't know anything about it, but apparently you didn't have to know anything about it. And that was a temporary instructorship. Then, that's when I was in the anti-aircraft shop. Then after that, after I finished this temporary stint, they made me a permanent, remember the permanent post personnel, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a big, stone and brick barracks with steam heat and, you know, fancy stuff for the permanent personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved in there, out of those wooden sheds and barracks. And stayed there for about a year as permanent personnel. And then towards the very end of the war, by that time the war was almost over in Europe. I guess they began scraping the barrel or something for men, but I think they'd started a new policy of rotating men back from the combat zones and replacing, well, actually they would rotate the men to the rear echelon and then back, and they'd send the rear echelon men up to the combat zones, and then they'd have to replace those rear echelon men. And so they started picking up those of us who had deficiencies of some sort. In this case, it's my eyes. I wore glasses. And so they started scouring all those around and sending them over to replace these rear echelon men. So I replaced somebody, I guess, who had always been going on up to the combat in Le Mans.
Out of France?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we landed, we went on a convoy, of course, out of New York, Camp Kilmer. And I really don't know much about the trip. Because they kept the ships shut up so tight. And only during the daytime when the weather was good could we get up on the decks. And you can't tell anything about a convoy while you're in it. You see ships off somewhere, but you don't know who they are or what they are. And they're such big things that sometimes you don't even see a ship here, but you know you're in a convoy.
Yeah.
Or supposed to be. And after about 10 days, I guess it was, we came into a little port in England, in Weymouth, one of the Channel ports. And I remember the thing that surprised me. We didn't get off the ship. We just laid overnight for a couple of nights in Weymouth. Weymouth is where up on the hillside they have this great big a white horse chalk sculpture, I guess you'd call it. White horse and some figures. They go back to Stonehenge, I guess, sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I remember seeing that and wondering about it. I didn't know anything about the antiquities of England at that time. And I thought, geez, White Horse Scotch people really go in for advertising over here. This is tremendous. Until later I found out that it wasn't White Horse Scotch at all. And that's about all I saw of Weymouth. In the next couple of days, after a couple of days, this portion of the convoy went over to the Havre and unloaded us in the Havre. That was my first contact with the war, really, you might say, was at the Havre. And it was a mess. The city, the area right around the harbor, had been bombed by the British while the Germans were still there. And the French told me that 15,000 people had been killed in this bombing, but they still hadn't dug out all the bodies. Their funerals were still buried in this rubble. And there was a big redeployment camp in the hill above Log. They marched us up there and had tents all around. You didn't have barracks or anything of that sort, but you didn't have to use your own tent. I guess I still had a half tent, puff tent, shelter half at that time. They loaded us up with so much. You know, the Quartermaster Corps had worked out a deal how to ship things overseas. Instead of loading them in ships, you know, in boxes or whatnot, they would load us down with all this equipment before we got on the ship, and we'd carry it over there and haul it around, and then they'd take it away from us as soon as we got over there and send it somewhere or put it in warehouses or something. But we had gas masks and all sorts of underwear, winter underwear, and this, that, and the other that we never used. And they'd issue it out and they'd take it away. But anyhow, this camp was, as I say, it was a sort of a temporary thing, with just tents. They had platforms in them, wooden platforms for you to sleep on, or folding cots. Mine was wooden platform. And this was in early April. It was cold, I remember. Very cold. Snowing a little bit. In this camp, they wouldn't let us build any fires. I guess we were afraid of, fire getting loose. Besides, you didn't have anything to build fire with. No wood. So I got in this tent. Me out by myself in that tent on this platform and tried to go to sleep. And I got colder and colder, and I kept piling stuff over me, all my blankets, my overcoat, everything else. And I couldn't figure out why I was still so cold till I realized that while I piled up everything on top of me, there wasn't anything underneath me except this wooden platform. And it was cold. I didn't sleep any that night. The next morning I was feeling sort of miserable. And they called a bunch of us out and marched us down the hill again onto a train. It was one of these second-class coaches, third-class coaches, the French railroad, little dinky thing with wooden seats. And the seats were about so wide, and in the middle would be a raised metal divider, a sort of part divider that would except, well, this one's wood, I guess. So you couldn't stretch out on these things because this thing was right in the middle. It'd catch you right in the middle of the back. And you just have to sit up. So there wasn't any room on the floor, and you couldn't stretch out on these seats. And the old train took off. I guess it was going from Le Havre to Paris, because we wound up in Paris in about 2 days. Well, what kind of trip is it ordinarily? About an hour and a half from Paris to Le Havre? Well, it took us about 2 days, but the reason it took us about 2 days was that all the bridges had been bombed and blown up, and they had to go through all kinds of detours in the countryside to get to Paris. And we'd pass through these little towns, you see, and where they'd repaired the bridges. And you would see all these bomb craters all around the bridge for miles. And in some cases, it hadn't hit the bridge at all, but it sure just torn up all the countryside. They were using the B-17s at that time, high altitude. They didn't know what they were hitting. They knew the general direction that they were supposed to be dropping. And I lived on that thing for about 2 days. And I don't think I ever got any sleep the whole time. I got into Paris. Didn't see much of it. It was foggy the day we came in early in the morning. Out in one of these big railroad yards, you know, where you don't see anything but tracks all around for miles. And nobody would tell us where we were going or, you know, you don't tell them this and then, but they find out. All we had to do, we pulled into a station somewhere along the line, I guess after we left this big yard, rail yard, pulled into a station apparently out in the suburbs of Paris somewhere. And there were people all up and down the concourse. And there's one lady all in black, looking like she was a widow. And she was standing there, and we'd yell out, "Where are we? Where are we going?" And she spoke English. And she told us exactly where we were going. She says, "You're going to Nancy-le-Sur or something of that sort." I've forgotten the name of it, if I ever really heard it accurately. But anyhow, she knew, I guess, troops going through there every day, you know, people come down to try to sell fake perfume and whatnot to the GIs. They know where all the trains go. And this was another redeployment camp, Repel Depot, so they call it. It was in, I say, a suburb of Paris, I suppose, maybe 10 or 15 miles from Paris. And it turned out that it was an old gunpowder plant that had not been used for many, many years, I guess, ever since they stopped making black powder. But all of the little rails with the little cars on them that they pushed stuff around all over the camp were still there. Some of the bunkers where they stored powder and I finally caught up with some sleep there. They put me out on guard duty. That's where I caught up with sleep. Rebel Devil, who's going to attack a redeployment camp? And the only thing that woke me up during my 2 hours of guard duty, the second time I was out, was a Frenchman. And I don't know whether he was a little beard up or what, but he lived somewhere very near. And he asked me to come home to his home with him, have a drink. Well, I didn't particularly want anything to drink, but I said I'd go home with him. So I say, just a little ways from where I was supposed to be guarding. So I went in, and he sat there and talked the French. He didn't speak any English at all. But what he was talking about, I could catch what he was talking about, partially by gestures, but he would talk about the mitrailleurs, and he had a medal that he got out and showed to me. And what I gathered was that he had been in the First World War as a machine gunner and had won this medal for something. I never was clear about exactly what he had done to win it, but he was very proud of it. And he liked to show it off, apparently. That's why he really brought me over there. Comrades at arms and all that. And I didn't stay very long. I had to get back before the new guards were posted. So I got back. And as soon as they were off guard duty, he had to put you on KP. So I spent the next 2 days on KP. Not because they caught me, but because all the new guys that come in, you see, they get all the dirty work. The old ones find out how to shuffle around. Then they put me on a train for Le Mans. I knew I was going to Le Mans because I had my orders. They'd been issued at the redeployment thing. And this old boy from Alabama, I was telling you about, and went on a Jeep tour with me. He was in the same compartment on the train. He was going to Le Mans too. He was going to. And this train was a lot different. It was one of the express trains, like the one that goes down to Biarritz and Mediterranean from Paris, fast electric train. And apparently they had kept this track in pretty good repair because it didn't detour. And in just a little while, we were rolling into Chartres, which is only about 30 miles or less from Le Mans. And I never forget my first glimpse of Chartres. Again, it was real early in the morning, and the mists were just rising from the ground. And I looked out, and it looked like a ship looming up out of the fog. And the fog cleared gradually, and as it cleared, well, then the spires became clear. And there was not a tree, it seemed like, anywhere around. It was all wheat fields.
All wheat fields.
Right. And by the time the spires became clear enough for me to see what they were, I realized that it was Chartres. I didn't know we were coming into Chartres at the time because they didn't tell us where we were going, and I didn't know the geography of France very well. But where Le Mans was, really a Chartres either, particularly. But there it was, it just floated up out of the mist. And it was all by itself. You couldn't see the town for a good while. There it was. Ever since then, I've always thought of that Debussy thing, the floating cathedral. We didn't stop at Chartres. Kept going to Le Mans. There was a truck that met these new people at the railroad station. Took us to a caserne in the middle of Le Mans, which had been the French barracks before the war and been occupied by Germans, used by the German occupying forces during the war, and was used as a, again, a sort of redeployment camp center. Stayed there overnight. It was comfortable enough. Even had a movie there. And the Germans had painted the walls. I remember they painted the walls of the big room where they gave the movies with all sorts of propaganda pictures. All done by hand, but it was still propaganda stuff all around the walls. And the next day, they sent me out to the Gnome Room place. And that was a sort of suburb of Le Mans. It was called the Cité des Pins, Pink City, because the Gnome Room factory or company had built a housing development for their workers. Right near the plant, going up the side of a hill, and they had apartments, they had duplexes, and they had single houses, all quite modern for that time. This would have been, what, 1942 or 3, all quite modern, a bathroom in each one, running water, plenty of room. And but this Pink City had been taken over by the American, this ordnance battalion, and they run all the French out. You know, they just, like they did most of the time during the war, they just move in and say, reuse this. You have to get your people out by such and such a time tomorrow. So all the French people who had lived in there were living, some of them, around the woods. Saw them around the city to pay in shacks. They didn't have any employment because the army had taken over there. Well, a few of them worked in the plant, but they were hungry. They were bad off, and they sort of resented, of course, the fact that their homes were being occupied by American troops. In fact, by the time I got there, the French looked on us just about the way they looked on the Germans. They considered us, you see, an occupying army, just as they could. The Germans were an occupying army. They didn't see much difference. After all, both armies did about the same thing to them. I don't think we rounded up any of them and shot them like the Germans did, but well, we probably killed just about as many with 6x6 trucks as Germans did, you know, accidents, road accidents. But the kids, we had our particular group, the artillery group. We were quartered in a group of these duplex houses. And each one of us had a private room. And, well, sometimes it was doubled up. And one of the houses had been made over into a mess hall and a kitchen. And another of the houses had been made into a bathhouse with showers in it. It was fixed up real nice. One thing you have to say for these ordnance boys, you know, they have all the tools, and they can requisition one way or another all the equipment they need, and any time they settle down anywhere, well, it becomes a little America right there with all the conveniences of home. They know how to do it, and this was the way this place was set up. Well, I guess the next thing that shocked me more than anything was after we would finish dinner or breakfast or supper, whatever it might be, they had those big cans where you're supposed to scrape the food, leftover food, and you played into these big garbage cans outside the mess hall. Then another set of garbage cans, you know, filled with water, hot water that you wash it. And there was a fence around this sort of yard outside the mess hall. And outside the fence were these little French kids, oh, anywhere from 4 on up to 13, 14, 15. And they'd lined this fence, and they had cans, old coffee cans or something. And they would hold them out through the fence. And of course, what they wanted you to do was to rake what was left in your plate into their cans rather than into the garbage cans. So most of the men had caught on to what was happening. So they'd always take double portions, the meals, so that they'd have a lot left over, so they could take them out and rake into these kids' buckets. There's very seldom anything went into the garbage can. Bones, maybe, or something of that sort. They were always there. They wanted food. They wanted soap. Those two didn't have any soap. And they wanted soap because a great many of them picked up a little money from the GIs by washing their clothes. And you had to furnish them the soap to old GI soap, orange, olive-colored stuff, lye, grandma's lye soap, very strong stuff. You'd have to furnish them the soap. The first time I went into town, was to a dance. Seems that the, I guess it was Red Cross, organized these dances for enlisted men and officers. Officers usually went to their own dances, but at some sort of a social club in the center of town. And they'd get girls, supposedly from nice families, to come dance with the enlisted men. And by and large, they were. Most of them were girls from nice families. I started dancing with one, spoke English very well, which was fortunate because I didn't speak English. And we danced and got to chatting, and it seems that her name was Claudette Chicot. And she really didn't live in Le Mans. That was her home. Her parents lived there. But she was working in Paris had been. I don't know whether she was still doing it during the war. But in the course of the opera scene. She was also a very good violinist. Her father was retired. He had been an engineer in the French railway. They lived in a very nice pension on the Rue Lamartine, in right next to a little stream, a little bridge across it, in Le Mans. But we got along quite well. And along about time for the dance to break up, they served refreshments. And the refreshments they got from all the mess halls from various American establishments, units in Le Mans, there were quite a number of them. They had a hospital unit, they had infantry outfit. They had, of course, this ordnance group. But they'd put out these cakes and all sorts of things that been cooked. Some of them, army cooks are not the best in the world by and large, and some of these cakes were pretty heavy, you know. But the minute they put them out, those girls deserted the men just as fast as they could, and they crowded around those tables, and you know what they were doing? They were grabbing these cakes and cookies and all that sort of thing and stuffing them into their handbags. They'd eat, if there was anything left after they'd stuffed their handbags full, they'd eat with, and we'd eat what was left. But they, that was what they came to the dance for.
To get
really,
the food.
To get the food. And Claudette was right in there with the rest of them. Well, I saw quite a bit of Claudette after that. She didn't stay in town. She commuted sort of over the weekends from Paris back to her family. And she'd get on a bicycle and she'd ride out to the Cité de Pain. And we would chat, talk, and they had me in to dinner one time. Even asked me into that dinner with them. And that was something amazing because, as I say, they were very short of food and they even had meat for this dinner. And they tried to teach me how to play some kind of a game like whist, I guess it was, something on that order after dinner. But I didn't learn. It'd take me longer than that to learn, especially in French. None of them spoke English except Claudette. She had to translate. But the old man was an interesting old fellow. He would try to talk about the war. They would point out that before the Germans skipped out of Le Mans when they were retreating after the Normandy campaign, that they'd come in and set up the machine gun in a window overlooking the approaching avenue when they thought maybe they would defend Le Mans, but they didn't. Turned out to withdrew. And they would tell about some of the incidents in Le Mans, some of the atrocities. They were very bitter about that. But I don't remember much about the details. But she said, while she wasn't there, if I wanted to practice, I could come around any time and use her violin. It was a nice violin. And I did a couple of times. I'd come around and I'd ring the doorbell at the gate, and you'd hear this little click. By then I'd learned that you didn't have to wait for people to come downstairs and open the door for you. You rang the bell, and then when you heard the little click, then that unlocked the door and we'd go on up. And I went up and practiced several times. Claudette told me about some of the history of the town, and went out to the Place Jacobin, which was right near the cathedral, next to the cathedral. And it looked like sort of an amphitheater, a U-shape, like a bleachers of a football stadium. And the French were in there playing football, soccer, it really was. And there were trees lining it, and it all looked very regular and so forth. And I happened to mention to Claudette, I said, that looks very nice. It's been here very long. We fixed it up very long for this game playing. And she says, yes, it's, Romans built it.
Yeah.
The Romans built it long before the cathedral had been built. And the Romans had a camp there, and they had built this thing for games, a fortress on top of the hill where the cathedral now was. That was the old city, Le Mans, with the real thick walls and the staircases that go down through the walls to the riverside. Steep staircase. She also told me some of the local gossip about the cathedral. She says that it was a monastery there. Used to be, not now. There was a convent on one of the adjoining rises of ground, maybe 500 or 600 yards away. And she says, you know, she says, and there was a tunnel that ran between that convent and that monastery. And she says, and look all around here. It's the old part of town, as I say, it's mostly slums then. Very poor people lived in these old quarters. She says, you know, all of this is owned by the church. It was also a red light district of the city. And she says, the church runs all this and gets all of its, most of its income around here from this area of town.
You know what? I remember now, Jack, where you started off a while ago at your ordnance headquarters there in Maryland. That the officers didn't know they wanted to put you in the officers' training school.
Yeah, right.
And that you preferred to just stay clear of those officers.
Yeah, I didn't see much in them to invite companionship. The enlisted men, some of them I was with, were in the ordnance, you see, were pretty high class people. One of my bunk fellows in basic training, father was a big shot in Minneapolis Moline. And when we finally, after 6 weeks or whatever it was, a basic training, they let us loose. We all hopped a train, that is, this boy and myself and another fellow, hopped a train, Pennsylvania train, into New York. And he took us around to the Plaza Hotel, and we stayed the whole weekend at the Plaza Hotel in his father's suite that he kept there all the time.
No use being an officer.
Why be an officer? So say with people like that. Well, you don't always run into people like that in the ranks, but there were a lot of them at this time. College graduates like myself, so young people. I don't know. Maybe there'd been some strings pulled to get them in ordnance instead of having them run into the infantry or some other. I don't know. Or it might have been that they just had the aptitudes for it. Some of those army tests were pretty screwy, but occasionally I guess maybe they worked out. Aptitude tests.
So, over there, when they gave you a jeep in 2 weeks to knock around in, you had pretty good company.
Yeah, it was a fine company. They were smart people, intelligent. Mm-hmm. They didn't know about Benedictine, some of them, but they knew about a lot of other things. And they were extremely practical and handy people. You didn't have trouble worry about traveling. They get along. On our way back from the south, going back to Le Mans, we stopped in a little town, I don't remember the name of it, but it was just before you get into the Champagne area, south of that a little bit. And it seems that we were the first Americans to come to this little village since the end of the war. We had liberated it. So they told us, the mayor, we were the liberators of this little city. Of course, Germans had gone a long time before, but they hadn't been able to celebrate because there hadn't even been anybody to celebrate with. So they wanted to put on a big affair and have a liberation celebration with us as the guests, the guests of honor. And it sounded tempting. But unfortunately, we were running out of time at that time. We had to be back. We couldn't stay. But you run into interesting people to talk to in the little restaurant in this town. Went in to have a meal, and there was a lady there. I guess there were lots of these scattered all over France. She had been a maid at one time to some wealthy family, New York. And she had lived in America for years, until I suppose she had saved up enough money to that she felt she could retire for the rest of her life, and she'd gone back to her little village to spend the rest of her life. And she was there, and she talked to us about New York and America. She was one that explained to us about the townspeople wanting to have this conveyed their invitation to us to remain for this big celebration they're going to put on. I think they even had lined up some of the pretty girls in the town for us. The French have a practical attitude about these things.
I like the arrangements you made with the little hotel that had more produce than they knew what to do with.
Yeah,
they didn't have any customers, you see, in this little city.
No transport.
They raised a lot of things around there, but they couldn't ship it anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And they were lacking, though, in certain things that you simply couldn't get in France during the war, such as sugar, coffee, and soap, and cigarettes, American cigarettes, maybe. So the army, when they gave us this jeep for this jeep tour, they required us to take gasoline along so that we wouldn't. The theory was that you were not to take things from the French because they needed everything they could get. So we were supplied with this and with sea rations, with all the food that theoretically we would need over this journey, this trip. But when we got to this little town, Poe and went to the little hotel there. It was a very nice hotel, as a matter of fact. Bob, this New Jersey boy, was telling Guy about, who was had such a winning personality and a good line of malarkey. He's the one that struck a bargain with the innkeeper that in return for our room and board with all this fresh food and French cooking and whatnot in the inn, we would trade him a certain amount of sea rations.
Oh.
You see, so he could get all that cheese and cigarettes and coffee and beans and all sorts of other things in these sea rations. And we did. We paid him off in sea rations. Well, he liked that arrangement, and we liked it, and worked out just fine. We even had some Benedictine there.
Well,
that was a place that I gained my spurs, I guess you might say, as being the spokesman for the group.
Uh-huh.
Because after I ordered Benedictine, the innkeeper and his daughter, who was helping him, my stock That little guy rose about 100% with them. The other boys didn't know anything about Benedictine. They didn't know what to do when you finished eating except shove your chair back and get up. But I says, no, I think I'll have a Benedictine if you have it. Yes, he had Benedictine. He brought out the whole bottle. And I sat there sipping my Benedictine, and you could just see these other guys watching me and watching the girl, watching the innkeeper, and they started hovering around me then, wanting to know if I'd like something else. And from then on, all the boys says, you get along with these people better than we do. You talk to them. I couldn't talk to them, but they thought I did.
The one thing that Debbie and them pick up when they are relating their experiences, this set doesn't follow that too well, because this is the first thing she did, and you'll see. It would work out kind of like this. Before this morning, before dinner, you actually had a little light thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to go to officer training school. He'd seen too many of those officers. He figured he'd better shape with the enlisted men.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So then he went on there, and then mostly though at Le Mans, and then that Jeep trip, you see,
mm-hmm.
which was that led into that one statement led into it. Well, now. Just a little statement opens up a lot of experience,
mm-hmm.
and the statement is not strong, it doesn't destroy or damage the experience or push it or crowd it or anything
yeah.
like that. See, it gives you all the leeway you want.
It's just
see.
The beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, gives you sort of an excuse,
mm-hmm.
and then you can relive the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, I kept seeing Jack with the enlisted men,
and
the enlisted men sort of took on color.
And now that's what I carry over. That's basically what we've done out here. And that's basically, you see, what I picked up from the countryside. That's about all I picked up from the countryside. All a lot of odds and ends, you see. And this business of you see, about all I do, you see, it just hold the subject open,
mm-hmm.
and it's very easy to hold it open. Bertie asks, well, what gets them started? That's not really a question.
It's what keeps them going that's the important thing.
And you see, I didn't make a sound over there all the time. I just let you wobble along on your chronological thing.
Right.
Well, that's about as primitive a method as you can get. Just a light ceases,
mm-hmm.
takes the burden off. So you don't struggle, you don't have to think, and you don't even have to remember where you get to next.
That was nice, yes. The
chances
were there missing.
So now that's what I got from the countryside, Jack. Just that.
Mm-hmm.
I just learned the green light, and you see it. The green light, it takes such a light green
mm-hmm.
light, you know, hardly a flick of the eye, just almost just listening is
mm-hmm.
a green light,
mm-hmm.
almost. And then sometimes you can pick it up now, you say you had Benedictine there, I said, Benedictine's that place, that's green
mm-hmm.
light,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't interfere with you,
right.
and it doesn't lead you anywhere,
mm-hmm.
so... You do it always, you see, just sort of in passing and make it, taking care, you see, not to scotch it or anything.
Right.
You know, I don't want to tell you what to say. I want to follow you.
Mm-hmm.
The flatheads would go out and they come in and they say, I don't know what I've seen until I talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's true.
Uh-huh.
That's true.
And then Rick would say, well, I didn't know I had saw that. And then, isn't that strange? I didn't know I saw that. As he talked, things
right.
would come to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's marvelous.
Jack got it easy. He's in good shape, eh?
I believe he's better than Flatheads.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the war.
Oh, yeah.
That I can't reconstruct it, but...
Jack,
I'm coming, no.
The names seem to be right there in his mind.
Well, I'm talking about the names, I'm talking about just the incident.
Incident.
Talking about the whole experience. It's sort of fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of fresh. He gets back into it easily, you see.
Doesn't seem like it was something that happened years ago.
No, and you know, funny thing about that business of getting back into it at the end of the war, I think I like myself, I was so disgusted with it and so tired of it and so dispirited by it that I said to myself, I don't want to remember any of this material. I'd have put it completely out of my mind.
Yeah.
I just consider it as a lost weekend sort of thing. And because I didn't see any good reason for remembering all of these things. And of course, there's a lot that I haven't said about that nobody will remember anyhow. But it comes back. It comes back. You can't consciously forget entirely.
I didn't put it aside. I kept it open there until the communists what closed my book. Because these people I knew in Kunming and back part of China were coming over there and visiting us.
Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
well, you see, you had contacts that lasted beyond the war. I didn't. Oh, the only thing that happened after the war, I think, was that when I got back, I got a big box of things like coffee and fruit juices and all sorts of things that I knew that they didn't have in France at all, and sent to the Chicot family.
Oh, really?
And that's,
mm-hmm.
I got a letter from them. Well, thank you.
Well, now, let me tell you, Jack, you see, you see it in the French experience. Debbie were with these people who had picked up the people in World War II that their parents had known in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept them, they kept it going.
Yeah.
And she was with two of them who did that.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's, and you say who would do that? It's in the culture somewhere along the line. Well, you see, they had all been in France for a year when they were 12 years old. And they learned to speak the language and write it, you see, so that they were always at home with them over there and kept in touch all the time. That's right. That's what did
mm-hmm.
it. Was that one year, it was a year abroad, but it was when they were 12 years old.
12 years old. Well, I'd been to France once before. I think I mentioned last night when I was a junior in the university, my roommate and I went to France. Well, we went elsewhere too, but spent much of the time in France. In 1937, the World Exposition in Paris that year. We went over on a freighter, old Ike's line, Liberty, World War I Liberty ship. And knocked around a while in France. But you don't get to meet people. very well that way. You're sort of hobos, you know, when you do that, and you don't have entree to people.
Well, you see how this works out. This is experience. I mean, you've learned something from this.
Yeah.
It's a whole new world for me. I get the position that I wrote the book, but I just read it a little bit before you got it. But what I don't say, what I eventually worked into was, when they came out here, they wouldn't get into the countryside, they'd stay within their own experience. Mm-hmm. Well, Debbie had just spent 6 or 8 months over there, so the normal thing for her to do was to write about what she did over there. Mm-hmm. That's the reason it was French and not just some other.
Right.
And I think that's, you can see how it worked. Now, before you start writing I don't know whether you're going to fix it or not, but suppose you're going to write on Miss Marion there. Well, the first thing you want to do is write on stuff that you got in your mind already and just take a typewriter and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, 30, 20 years is a little bit of a distance for it. You'd want to pick up something a little less remote. But you see, hers was she was right out of it. And then you see what you do. I told you what I put on that little notice, wanted writers, own experience of others.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you start out with your own experience and then gradually go into the experience of others.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, that would be so much interested and much more interesting than my experience. That's where I would stay.
Yeah.
Now you've got something to go on, you see. When you get into it.
Yeah, she was coming out tonight, but you're all not going to be here, so she'll be.
Channel 2, right around 1200, and the end of this talk with Jack on his Army experiences this Tuesday, the 21st of May, 74. Channel 2, right around 1200, and the end of the talk with Jack and Faye on his Army experiences this Tuesday afternoon, the 21st of May, 74.